Welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man who rose to stardom when, after months and months of arduous podcast recording, one night he accidentally mixed three of his podcasts into one super podcast without realizing it. And because of this, he rose to fame.
Okay.
It's Robert Lamb.
Howdy, partner. See what I did there?
Oh my gosh. No, I don't. Oh,
well, you'll see soon.
So you're months and months of podcasting, right? You're exhausted. And so you take clips from Paralyzed, then you take clips from Let's Dance, and then you take clips from What's Inside This Cantaloupe, three of your podcasts. And you somehow combine them, not really realizing it because you're just so sleep deprived. And you had a hit. You, like, it was lightning in a bottle. I mean, it exploded.
I have a whole new series. It's just those three now. I combine them into one ultimate movie, or not movie, but one ultimate podcast. It's a paralyzing dance with cantaloupes.
Oh, and you know when I knew that your podcast made it, there's about 47 podcasts that just review each episode of your podcast, and they're all in the top 20 charts on iTunes. So podcasts that review your podcast are in top 20. You made people famous.
Yeah, it's a little disappointing because my podcast isn't up there, but theirs is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like, do I have to listen to Robert's, or would I rather listen to reviews of his podcast?
You know, honestly, I do that sometimes. I listen to How Did This Get Made, which is them talking shit about crappy movies, and I don't always watch the movies that they're talking about.
Yeah, oh, I do the same thing, because some of them I don't want to watch, and I just sort of listen to that.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm just like, I'll skip watching it, and I'll just listen to some funny commentary about it.
Yeah, it's, you know, drive, listen to them slam. I mean, I feel like some of the recent podcasts, though, they've really started slamming movies, and I kind of liked it more when they were like, hey, what's a Street Fighter? Or kind of, you know what I mean? Because it's easy to slam Look Who's Talking Now.
Do you think they'll run out of bad movies?
No.
Okay.
I mean, they do two a month.
That's true, yeah.
I mean, that's only, like 24 a year. So, I mean, eight bad movies just came out right now.
Yeah, every week. As
we're talking, a bad movie just came out. So they're set.
Yeah, that's true.
They're all good. So, I mean, Paralyzed While Dancing with Cantaloupes, what I love about it is how you never know where it's going.
No, and that's the point. I don't even know. It's just the way that I edit them together. Sometimes it creates a story that I didn't even see coming.
Like, think about this. You're on a hill in San Francisco, right? And you have a cantaloupe.
Hey, really quick. I think about that every day.
Yeah. I mean, why not? Right?
Yeah.
Parallel parking on one of those with a bunch of grills in your back of your truck.
Fun.
I had to do that last year. It was miserable. I did it. Ugh. But everyone was staring at me like I was an idiot. Then I had a beer. But all right. So you're on the top of a hill in San Francisco, right? And you roll a cantaloupe down one of those hills. You don't know where it's going. Like,
right.
You, no scientist could say this is the course that this cantaloupe is going to take.
I actually, side story, I did go to San Francisco. I've been there a couple times, and I usually do take fruit, and I do roll it down the hills, and that's only because I'm trying to recreate, with just fruit, the classic chase scene in Bullet. So it's really hard to do it because it's hard for fruit to take those sharp turns, but I'm getting closer.
And you have to clear all the streets, too.
I don't want fruit hitting people as they're driving.
This is very expensive, Robert.
I go through a lot of fruit, but I think the most expensive thing is actually flying out to San Francisco.
And the street permits to lock down the road, the police. I mean, you're dropping $30,000 a day.
Yeah, but when I get this shot of, like, the fruit rolling down the hill, taking sharp turns and blowing up gas stations, it'll be worth it.
Yeah, it's too bad that they already made that movie in the 80s. Called Apple.
Shit.
Yeah. So are you using apples?
No, I was using cantaloupe.
All right, you're all good then. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, you're remaking Apple with a cantaloupe.
Yeah, I am. Do you think that's copyrighted?
What, cantaloupe?
I mean, well, if I use a different fruit, that's okay, right?
Like, what do you mean? If you use a different, like, banana?
Like, if I use, like, if I'm, like, making a phone and I call it cantaloupe, and it's a smartphone, and it has most, if not all, of the same features that the new iPhone has. Is that any way, like, am I stepping on anyone's toes? You know what I mean?
So, that's really interesting. So they're So Apple would sue you and be like, listen, apples are fruit and so are cantaloupes.
Right.
Man, that'd be dirty.
Hey, okay, so not to like really like – I hate to bring this up because it makes me look weird. But a while back, I would just like have iCarly on and like as a joke, me and my girlfriend would watch it. And there was a thing on there one time where they had like their iPhone thing was – it was a pair. And they're obviously making fun of, you know, Apple iPhone and stuff like that. But they're all shaped like pears and stuff. So what if I did that, but I just did it with a cantaloupe and it was just a circle phone?
Be perfect. Do it.
Yeah, see? All right. I got it.
You should call it the circle phone, a.k.a. cantaloupe.
Cantaloupe.
Yeah.
Cantaloupe. Apple cantaloupe. It's got a ring to it, I guess.
That reminds me of that movie Club Dread. Where the woman's name is Penelope, but he calls her Penelope.
Oh, Penelope.
That movie's nice. Very underrated. If you're listening to this, just check out Club Dread. Bill Paxton's really good in it. It's a funny movie, Club Dread. It's underrated.
I like Bill Paxton, but I will admit I don't really care for Broken Lizard that much. Did you see Super Troopers 2? I didn't watch it.
You know what? All right, so they're going to hate me for this, but so whenever they released all their DVDs, they always have commentaries. Two commentary tracks where they break up the Broken Lizard guys and they talk about the movies. And I've always found them to be very informational, a lot of great material behind the making of them. I love to hear about the making of these movies because they're lower budget. They did it on their own. So they crowdfund Super Troopers 2, and then they release the DVD with one extra, or Blu-ray with one extra. And I'm like, wait, why is there no – this is a crowdfunded movie. There should be commentary, shouldn't there?
Yeah, why not?
I don't know. They're going to be like, get over yourself. But that kind of bummed me out when I saw that.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. I forgot that was a crowd-funded movie.
I mean, put some commentaries.
What did it cost, like $5 million or something
like
that?
Yeah, they raised a bunch, and then they were able to raise more with that $5 million.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think that the final budget was probably over $10 million, $14 million, $12 million, something like that. Yeah, it made money.
Yeah, that's not bad.
So that, I mean, you know, Super Troopers. No, that doesn't remind us of the movies we're talking about today, does it?
I mean, they were wearing hats.
Yeah.
And hats kind of segues into what we're about to talk about.
Yeah, Major League, they wore hats too. So does that segue in?
Well, yeah, but they wore like brown hats.
Got baseball hats.
I mean, well, no. Major League they did. I thought you were talking about Super Troopers.
Yeah, Will Kane's not walking around with an Angels hat on.
I heard that was all kind of made up, like the whole cowboy hat thing, because they used to fly off like when they were on the horses and stuff, that it would make it impractical for them to wear those.
I mean,
is that true?
Man, any time that I've ever galloped on a horse, I've been frightened out of my mind and just struggled for life. And I never had a hat on, so I couldn't tell you. It's worth looking into.
Unless, like, don't they have the chin straps on some of them? Like the strings, like kind of bring it down underneath your chin. They never did that in the movies, but... It seems like you're riding a horse, like you would think the wind would pick up the hat unless it was real snug.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's a very good question, Robert.
I'm just saying, if I was wearing a baseball cap, I'm not sticking my head out the window like a dog.
Yeah.
Just because I'm worried it's going to fly off.
Exactly. Or on a roller coaster.
Right.
So you're a cowboy on a horse. I mean, maybe just walking around town.
Yeah, I guess that's fine. But if you're in a chase... It just doesn't seem practical to have a cowboy hat on.
If I was a cowboy hat, I would just buy cheap hats because I lose them all the time. It's like when I go on vacation, I buy $5 sunglasses. So if a couple of them break or I lose one, it doesn't matter.
That makes sense.
So are you saying that cowboys just wear $5 hats?
They just have like back then it was probably like a nickel.
Yeah, and a penny.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a barter.
They just had like 6 hats hanging off the back of the horse, and they just replace them every time they lose one.
A horse has a coat rack, a hat rack?
Because Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid are not going back for a hat when they're getting chased, so they might as well, you know, have a bunch spare ones.
That'd be funny if they got caught because of all the hats that flew off of them.
It left like a trail like of breadcrumbs.
That's how the guys knew how to follow them, that posse of just amazing hunters.
That makes sense, because they always caught up to them.
You know, who are these guys? So these two movies, I love that you picked them because they're both – if you put together a list of the top 20 Westerns of all time, these two would be in the list every time, right?
Oh, yeah.
Or 97% of the time. There'd be some contrarian.
I think High Noon would definitely be in it. The Rio Bravo would 97%.
I mean, It's just these, but the interesting thing is they are completely different movies. One is an 85-minute, low-budget, black-and-white, economical, almost anti-Western.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's High Noon. And then Rio Bravo is, as Quentin Tarantino calls it, what, a hangout movie?
It's like a hangout movie, but it's like your traditional kind of John Wayne Western. Yeah.
With a more sensitive performance from John Wayne.
Yeah, it is. It's I noticed that the film, because like you're saying, they're like on different spectrums, in the sense of like High Noon is more like dark and gritty and like kind of like more dour, whereas like Rio Bravo's almost like, even though there's killing and people die and stuff, it's still kind of more of an upbeat. It's got some comedic elements to it. It's a different kind of like more lighter Western.
Yeah, and I mean, they take time for Ricky Nelson and Dean Martin to sing A Beautiful Number.
Yeah, they sing two songs.
Oh yeah, like really great music in there. That kind of surprisingly happens, but I guess if you're going to have Dean Martin and Ricky Nelson in a movie, you should probably...
Although, oh, sorry, not to cut you off, but High Noon had that one song.
Oh, yeah.
What's it? Killing Frank Miller? I forget what it's called. But that song actually won an Oscar in High Noon. And that was the first, I think I read on IMDb, it was the first non-musical Oscar for a song at the Oscars.
Oh, wasn't it Do Not Forsake Me, My Darling?
Yeah, something like that. No, but, wait. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and so it's basically a song about the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, about, you know, oh, Tex Ritter did it.
Yeah, it kind of summarizes, like, what the movie is about.
Yeah, so it's like the original, it's like Seal. Seal Kissed by a Rose was. It was Wild Wild West. West, Desperado, Rough Rider. No, you don't want none of this. Six Gun, weighing a ton of this.
Do you think Will Smith saw High Noon, learned of the song, and was like, we need to do that for Wild Wild West, or this thing's not going to get picked up?
Oh, 100%.
Okay.
I mean, he did it for Men in Black, but obviously that's because of High Noon. Mm. And so we just say, hey, that's what I'm doing. But this, I mean, you know what I love about High Noon, right? I guess we're kind of bouncing all over the place, but Rio Bravo was almost made because the director hated High Noon.
So
Howard Hawks hated High Noon.
Fred Zinnemann directed High Noon with Gary Cooper, and Howard Hawks directed Rio Bravo with John Wayne. Howard Hawks and John Wayne did not like High Noon, which came out in 1952.
Yep.
It came out in 1952. They did not like it because they felt it wasn't – they felt it was an un-American film. So the idea that Gary Cooper – I got to remember all their character names. But Gary Cooper, who plays Will Kane, like he couldn't get any help through this town. Like he's walking around the town and the whole movie, which takes place almost pretty much in real time.
I think there are 80 minutes, right?
Yeah, I think they did they had to re-edit it or something, so it's not specifically real time, but it's really close. And basically, Will Kane is just walking around, trying to get somebody to help him fight what's his name, Frank Miller, who's on this train, who's going to be there at noon and coming to get revenge or whatever for Kane arresting him, what, like 5 years ago or something like that.
Yeah, he put him in jail.
Right, but he got pardoned, and now he's coming back, and he's got a posse of three guys who are waiting for him, which one of them is played by Lee Van Cleef.
Dude's awesome.
That's his first role in a movie, and he has no speaking lines.
I love their introduction, too, just the way they shot them.
Right.
I mean, they just – the movie starts with them just coming to town, and I love how no one's like, oh, they're the bad guys. They just – everyone in town knows who they are, and they're like, oh, crap. Like, this is not good.
You know what's funny about, like, both these Westerns is, like, there's these bad guys, and they're in the town, basically, but the sheriffs can't do anything about it because they're not technically breaking any laws. Mm-hmm. But they're just there, and the sheriffs know that they're bad guys. Even John Wayne, you know, he knows that the guys waiting outside the saloon are with, you know, are part of the posse that's, like, the bad guys, and he just can't arrest them for anything. And he even tells, I think – he tells Dean Martin that, like, I can't arrest them. They haven't done anything yet. And if I arrest them, I'm just going to have more people in jail for them to come get or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that's exactly what he says. Yeah, he's like, if I arrest him, then they, like, you know, the brother he was talking about, if I arrest the brother, then they're all just going to come into town.
Right.
And
that's, yeah.
I mean, I love that, though. I love that you have these villains in town in both movies, and it's just they're waiting. I mean, trouble. So they're both very suspenseful in different ways. So you have High Noon in 80 minutes. They're coming. He needs to find help. And then you have in Rio Bravo, trouble's everywhere. Trouble's around the corner. I mean, you know, if you even offer to help John Wayne and his posse, you can get killed, which does happen.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the difference. That's the difference between the movies, is that because John Wayne and Howard Hawks didn't like the take of High Noon, where there's this sheriff who's scared and worried and trying to find help, they went the opposite way and had John Wayne be the sheriff, who's, you know, John Wayne's macho guy, who's everybody's offering their help, and he's kind of turning them down. Like, no, I don't need your help. No, you'll be no use of me, like, use to me. Like, just don't worry about it. You have all these guys have kids and families. Don't worry about it, kind of stuff. And it's like the complete opposite of what High Noon was.
And you know, Wayne's like, oh, you know, it's going to be pros versus amateurs. I don't need you.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I noticed that Rio Bravo's a lot more about manliness than High Noon is. It's a lot more of just, you know, like you notice like all the kind of like, you know, I'll walk with you and I'll hold your hand. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's a lot more about just kind of being a man. Does that make sense? Whereas High Noon, I guess when I say man, just like in quotation marks for anybody, like being brave or living up to yourself or living up to, you know, helping your friends.
Well, these are older movies. So obviously there's always like the guys, like the macho type, a stereotype that they have for like these type of, you know, older films. Like that's just how men were portrayed. But in High Noon, yes, I think Will Kane, you see him and he's actually kind of like worried and he's almost scared. And that was something that John Wayne was never scared of. He wasn't scared of getting killed. He wasn't scared of like that kind of stuff because he was more of a manly sheriff.
I think that just captures it so much better though in High Noon. Just the way there's four dudes that are very good shots coming to kill me.
Right. And I can't get help.
And I love how Grace Kelly, she, you know, one of her maybe first major role after some commercials and everything, she got paid $7,000 or $750 or something like that. That's why she got hired. But she wants to take off. And he's like, listen, they're going to come after us. And it's better for us to be in this town than it is for us to be on a farm somewhere.
But I also think he says that in the beginning because he thinks he can get some help and he doesn't. Like, yeah. You know what I mean?
I guess he could have posted up on like a hilltop or something like that and he would have been a lot better off. Like in the Ballad of Buster Scruggs, there's a cool scene where a guy posts up. But but I thought that was pretty interesting. He's like, I just know they're probably going to come after me. So he turns around. And you know what I think is interesting about this movie? So Rio Bravo, the movie, just watching it, I think is super interesting. But the behind the scenes story of High Noon, I really love. You know, Fred Zinnemann did storyboards on these movies. And he did over 400 shots in 4 weeks.
Yeah, I read that on IMDb. That's crazy.
And then I also listened to two documentaries. I was stuck in Atlanta traffic, and so I just put things on through my Bluetooth. I don't watch them, but I just listen to them. And, yeah, they wanted to do a very stark. They didn't want to show the expansive, beautiful sky. You know, you think about Westerns, and you just think about the sunsets, the plateaus, the beautiful sunsets, the campfires. If you watch this movie again, it's a lot of close-ups. They don't really show the openness. I would say the most open shots that they do show are down the railroad, just waiting for the train to come. So they really do a nice job showing claustrophobia in High Noon. And I love how each shot at the clock gets closer.
Yeah, and I like also, like, not to jump ahead too much, but where they do that the quick shots of everybody near the end when the train's supposed to be there soon, like it's almost noon, and they're showing all the quick shots of everybody that Will Kane talked to and how everybody looks kind of worried and kind of depressed. Like, there's certain people who wanted to help him, but they just couldn't because they were either old or like that one guy didn't have one eye. But for the most part, like a lot of people turned him down, or like the guy who hid in the closet while his wife answered the door, like that kind of stuff. Like they all look really sad, and it just starts doing these quick shots of everybody in the town. And then you hear the train horn, like right as it's pulling up. I thought that was a cool shot.
Now I have a question for you. There's a line where this guy's like, I wouldn't leave this town for all the tea in China, because he doesn't like Will Kane and he wants to see Kane die. But I looked up how much the tea in China costs, and I found some rough numbers. They're saying that 5.36 billion tons of tea was made in 2016. And they did the math of how much it could sell on average, and he said $100 billion around there. So would you leave town for $100 billion?
Yeah. I'd leave town for
50 bucks.
100,000. Yeah.
I'd be like, wait, all right, so you just want me to leave town for the afternoon and then come back and you'll give me $100,000?
Yeah. Oh. Is that the guy who was worked at the hotel?
Yeah, and he's just like ultimate slime burger.
Yeah.
In this movie. And I just kind of loved I just kind of loved how slimy he was. And I also loved – I keep saying love. I really liked Helen in this movie. What Katie – what's her last name? Gerardo? She played –
Katie Gerardo, yeah.
Yeah, she played Helen. I loved her in this movie. It was really refreshing to have that kind of character and just the smack she talked to Lloyd Bridges.
Because she was with Will Kane, but then she was also with Frank Miller before him, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so that's it. Her and Frank look at each other when she gets on the train or whatever, and he just kind of walks by. But she even told – she's the reason why Grace Kelly went back, was because she told him, like, I would stand by Will Kane. I would have a gun too or whatever.
And then Grace Kelly helps out.
Yeah, and she helps out at the end. And Helen says the only reason why she wasn't going to help out then, which is the Katie Gerardo – she said, because, you know, Will Kane's not mine anymore. So Grace Kelly, I think, realized that and was like, you know what, I am going to go back.
So I showed this movie to my students, and I had them write reviews. And it was funny just watching them getting really into it. And they were like, yelling at the screen when everyone's like, I can't help you, Will. And then when Grace came back and shot one of the guys, they started cheering in the class. So this is, you know, this 1952 movie, kind of like an anti-Western, and my entire class was into it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. And then, I don't know, John Wayne's like, he spends the entire movie looking for help, and then he just takes him out by himself. But, I mean, you don't –
you mean Will Kane?
Yeah,
did
Will
you say
Kane.
John Wayne?
Well, John Wayne got mad at this movie because he's like, Will Kane looks for help, and then he just kills him by himself. He's like, the thing's stupid. But I don't think they understood – you know, this movie – The writer, Carl Foreman, he was blacklisted. He actually won an Oscar later for Bridge on the River Kwai. They gave it to him actually later than that movie. But he was blacklisted because he was a former member of the Communist Party. And so he wrote it. It was like intended as an allegory for the failure of the Hollywood community to stand up to the House of Un-American Activities Committee during Senator Joseph McCarthy's communist hunt. So they were basically having... this whole thing was a statement about that. And actually, I thought it was a statement about World War II, about how late we were to get into the war. That's what originally I thought it was. People are like, hey, we already had World War I. We don't want to get back into it. We want to kind of see what happens even after Pearl Harbor. So I thought at first it was that, but it's more of just an allegory for the communist hunt during the late 40s and 50s.
I mean, that would make sense because, yeah, like John Wayne and Howard Hawks thought it was super un-American. So that would make sense.
And you know that KKK picketed this movie?
Really? Why?
They just said it was un-American because they had a Jewish writer, and then it was also about a man not, you know, looking for help and people not helping him. They were like, this is un-American.
So, yeah, but I love the idea that, like, it had to follow some kind of, like, strict code or whatever. Like, I think some of the best movies are the ones that don't follow, like, that format. You know what I mean? Like Tarantino doesn't follow strict act one, act two, act three formats and stuff, and his movies are still great. I mean, there's just different things. Like the fact that it was, you know, an allegory for that, and for the fact that it was like – it was different than other Westerns, I think, is why it stands out.
It was almost like The Last Jedi. I love how things things don't change, really. I mean, you make a different movie, and listen, there are complaints about that movie, obviously, but people really had a lot of vitriol towards that movie. And I guess that's kind of like with High Noon. People just were – I mean, it was a big hit, though. I mean, it was a massive hit. It won – Gary Cooper won an Oscar for it. You know what's really interesting is this documentary I listened to. It was about the guy who wrote the book for High Noon, and it's just a lecture about the movie. And if you watched it, it'd be really boring, but listen to it, it was cool. It was kind of neat that – so the producers did not want Gary Cooper. He fought for the role. He took the pay cut. And then they were really worried about his performance because they thought he was sleepwalking in it. Like, he was like, this is just a Gary Cooper. But I think once they saw everything together, they're like, oh, that's what he was doing.
Yeah, I heard they wanted Gregory Peck or something first.
Yeah, they had multiple people turn down the role.
Yeah. Well, I think Gregory Peck, they said, wanted to do it but couldn't because – or turned it, he turned it down because he did another movie – before this one, which was a Western, that was – he said it was too similar or something, but he regrets turning it down, obviously, now.
I just like – I think this movie works best with Gary Cooper because what he was doing. It was like a sensitive portrayal, and I think that's what sort of makes the movie. You know how Bruce Willis in Die Hard, he's like a jokey cop. Like he's – it's absurd, but he doesn't have that super macho swagger. He's just kind of like a – does that make sense? He's like just he's like a cockroach almost that Alan Rickman can't kill. Hans Gruber can't kill.
But I think that's what makes – like especially nowadays, like the types of movies that people watch now are you have a hero, but you have a hero who has to overcome something great that has flaws that feels more human – in essence, whereas I feel like a lot of older movies, like any kind of older film, like a lot of times the main character was almost superhero-ish, kind of how James Bond turned out to be, like in the 70s with Roger Moore. He was almost like a superhero.
He had zero problems, too.
Exactly. I mean, there wasn't anything to like overcome and stuff. And even like John Wayne movies, while there are a lot of good ones, and I won't say that they're all like this, there are like True Grit's not like this at all, but there are other ones that I've watched where he doesn't feel like he has any flaws. Like he just feels like John Wayne, the man who's doing what he has to do.
And this can definitely be argued, but with John Wayne, my idea of his most iconic role is a Searchers, right, where he becomes a broken man through the course of his, you know, hunt to get I forget the actress's name. Natalie Wood, where he gets her back, and then he walks away, sort of a shell of his former self. So he finally showed that side, and he's in one of the greatest, you know, I'd say top five Westerns of all time, the Searchers. And that definitely came after Rio Bravo, I believe.
No, actually, I think it's before.
Really?
Which is weird, because they said that he didn't do a Western.
Oh, 56. He did it in 56, you're right.
Yeah, but he didn't do a Western for a while, so that must have been his last – I think The Searchers was his last Western until Rio Bravo. I think he came back and did Rio Bravo. But the funny thing is him and Howard Hawks remade Rio Bravo like three times.
Yeah.
They did it as El Dorado, which I watched El Dorado, and it is a very similar movie to Rio Bravo, except that instead of Dean Martin, it's Robert Mitchum, and instead of Colorado, I think it's – or instead of Ricky Nelson as Colorado, I think it's James Caan as Mississippi. So it's a very similar storyline and everything. Like even Robert Mitchum's a drunk in El Dorado. And then I think they remade it again similarly as Rio Lobo, which was again in the 60s.
I watched one of those movies and I thought that was Rio Bravo. And then I learned what Rio Bravo was. And I was like, wait, I haven't seen this.
Oh, yeah, I think it might have been El Dorado.
I guess what I was getting at with The Searchers, and I'm not saying – because John Wayne also did The Quiet Man in 52. He had his fair share, but I guess with Ford did The Searchers, but he also did Quiet Man, Grapes of Wrath, How Green Was My Valley. He did The Searchers. He had more of a sensitive run to him. At least that's what I think, as opposed to Howard Hawks.
Right.
So maybe that's kind of why he got that performance. But, You know what, though? John Wayne isn't full of... I'm not going to say John Wayne was full of swagger in Rio Bravo. I mean, there's scenes in that movie when he's dealing with... Angie Dickinson, Feathers?
Yep.
Where he kind of melts when he deals with her. And she kind of puts him through the ringer, which you're not really used to. Does that make sense?
There is a lot of teasing going on, like, from her perspective. Like, she's teasing John Wayne a lot. And, you know, he gets almost, like, flustered, which is, like, interesting to see because you don't expect that from that. And, like, you're talking about the Macho Man thing. And I think it's interesting in this movie because I've watched a lot of old films and they don't do a lot of, like the humor in Rio Bravo where John Wayne, like you said, Dean Martin was like, you want to hold hands or something like that? And he's like, go back over across the street. Like, they're, like, patrolling the area. And that comment, plus, like, when they open up the package and it's, like, the tights, like, ladies' tights or whatever.
The red pants.
Yeah. What's his name? The hotel owner puts it up against John Wayne's legs and talks about, like, him trying it out. And he's like, I don't think you want me to do that. Like, I was surprised they actually had those types of jokes in this movie.
And then,
it doesn't feel like an old-timey type like, usually they don't do those kind of jokes.
And then John Wayne kisses that one guy in the head, then he hits him in the butt with a broom in response. You know what's crazy now? Once you watch this movie and you watch Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction, a lot of just the kind of hanging out and talking, you can see where his movies come from.
Yeah, Tarantino said that Rio Bravo – he shows Rio Bravo to, like, whatever girl – like, if he's starting to date a girl, he shows her Rio Bravo. And if she doesn't like it, then they don't go out again.
Oh, my gosh. I hope he still doesn't do that.
I don't know. I remember reading that – or not reading it. I remember seeing it somewhere, like, some interview.
Oh, he said it for sure. He definitely said that. What movie do you show?
I show too many. I think the movie that I've shown to girlfriends the most – it's got to be – or not just girlfriends, like friends, everybody. It's got to be The Graduate because I feel like a lot of people don't watch – like haven't seen that movie, and it's such a different type of film. I show them The Graduate, and if people don't like The Graduate, then we just can't be friends.
So get this. For my film studies class, my students are writing their papers about the 1968 Academy Awards, the Best Picture nominees, which are Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, In the Heat of the Night, The Graduate, Bonnie and Clyde, and Dr. Doolittle. And I screened all five in class throughout the semester and their final papers on it just so they can watch it so they can't be like, I didn't see it. I asked all of them what their favorite was, and every single one of them said The Graduate.
Yeah,
a good movie. I don't think they're used to that kind of film where he's banging his head on the wall. And at the end when he's swinging the cross at all those people, I mean, everyone was just cheering in the classroom. I mean, I love it. And a lot of my students were like, you know what, Mark? I used to think old movies were old. But now I'm realizing that they're great. I'm like, cool.
Dude, that movie came out in 67, man. I mean, that's crazy. Like, it's such a art house type of film. And, like, the camera work is so different from, like, what you normally saw in the 60s or earlier. And even the content of it, like, the fact that they're, like cheating and having an affair and stuff. Like, it just felt like a really grown-up film. And I know the 60s was kind of around that point. Almost dropped my mic. Is around that point where, like, movies started to kind of branch out and become more artistic and start, like, kind of pushing the envelope, like, when it came to storylines and acting. So I think that that's, like, part of the reason why The Graduate was able to be made.
Oh, for sure. And you know, Bonnie and Clyde was also massive during the time. A lot of them were really influenced by the French New Wave.
Yeah.
You know, Breathless. Because Breathless has a lot to do with Rio Bravo. That's a hangout movie. Wait, Breathless is a hangout movie?
It is.
And actually, that director, I'm losing serious – Godard, right?
Yeah, Godard. Yeah.
Godard. He loved Bogart movies, and so you could really see that in Breathless. So maybe he watched Rio Bravo and was like, man, they're just hanging out.
Was Humphrey Bogart ever in a Western? He had to be, right? I thought he was.
I keep thinking about, like, African Queen, but that's not. And then I think about The Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
So that's kind of a Western. That is a Western, right?
Ish, right? I guess if someone stuck their head in the sand and said it was, you wouldn't want to argue with them anymore.
I mean, it takes place in the West. I mean, that's a.
I mean, during the time, Bogart had to have been in a Western. We'll look it up during the break.
Yeah, that's fine.
Right. No, and then I don't know if you read, you remember that article I sent over to you about the opening of Rio Bravo? People seem to think that it's one of the greatest openings of all time. Just the kind of wordless or slightly few words are used. Just like the final 15 minutes of High Noon, which are, there's about 8 words in the last 15 minutes in those. So it's interesting how the beginning of Rio Bravo opens with a kind of a wordless intro. Beautiful shots. I mean, do you think Sergio Leone kind of used that kind of editing for The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly in his films?
Yeah, I think he used Lee Van Cleef also.
Yeah.
took him over there. Yeah. No, but yeah, I mean, I think like the way Rio Bravo is a very, granted it's in Technicolor, but it's a very colorful film and shot like you said, High Noon's more close-knit and very like claustrophobic, whereas Rio Bravo doesn't really feel like that. It all takes place in one town, which is kind of cool. Like both of them do, but the way they're both shot are like vastly different, like wide angle shots and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's what separates them even more is the fact that like not only are they different in terms of storyline, but it's also the way they're shot.
And when I think about the two, when Rio Bravo pops into my head, I see these really, you know, wide shots of the town, the roads. And so even though there is a slightly, not, I'm not going to say claustrophobic, but it's in one setting, it still feels expansive in a way, even though they're hanging out. But when I think of High Noon, I just think about, I mean, close-ups and shots of clocks.
Well, even the ending in the sense of the shootout, like the huge shootout in Rio Bravo takes place at like the abandoned warehouse or whatever. And it's like this huge area where they're all splitting up and they're all firing dynamite and shooting at dynamite in there and stuff. Whereas like High Noon takes place on that same street that he keeps walking down back and forth. And he's actually hiding out in like a building on the side while they're walking down. Like it's all very like, it feels like a lot closer.
And those, and also when you think about the shots of the four villains walking through the street, they had them kind of in medium shots for all four. They didn't have really a, like when they are walking, the camera's going right next to them.
Yeah.
With that. Yeah. That's really, it's pretty disorienting, like the way they did that. I mean, that's what Fred Zinnemann did though. He did a great job on a shoestring budget in like, what, 20 days.
Yeah. I don't think, Rio Bravo really even had that many close-ups at all either.
No.
Did it?
It had, I don't think so. It had more like the two shot.
Yeah.
Then maybe had, I don't know if it had many over-the-shoulder shots, but I do know, when I think of Rio Bravo, I just think of the two shots, you know.
Well, and also to talk about the opening scene where you're saying that there's not, like, there, you know, there's no talking for, like, 4 minutes. I mean, that's classic movie making in the sense of show, don't tell. So you get to see these characters before like you even hear them utter any words. Like you get to see who they are. Like the, even the upshot of like the angle of John Wayne walking up to Dean Martin, who's on the ground, you know, trying to get some money out of a spittoon while John Wayne's standing above him, towering above him. Like you get to see that John Wayne's like the big guy, like the one in charge, while Dean Martin's the drunk who's like groveling for money so he can buy a drink. You get to see the bad guy. You get to see Dean Martin hit John Wayne, which like right there causes some dilemma between them. But then also Dean Martin helps him drag the bad guy off at the very end of their scuffle. So you can kind of see like the feeling that they have this like John Wayne knows Dean Martin's like trouble, but also gets help from Dean Martin at the same time.
Now, you know what's funny? The note I wrote is, it's gangster how they captured Joe in the beginning. Straight up hit him with a rifle.
Yeah, yeah.
It's such a beautiful setup. And you know what's weird is I didn't really appreciate that until I read the article. Then I went back and watched it and went, holy crap, how did I miss this?
Yeah. And he like – and I forget the character's name, but the one Joe that they arrest or whatever, he shoots that guy who just tries to stop him from causing any more trouble. It's just some random guy just taps him on the shoulder, tells him no, like doesn't say anything, just shakes his head, and then he just gets shot. And that's what starts this whole thing, is he murders the guy in cold blood.
Oh man, I love these movies. All right,
yeah,
so
they're great.
How about this, let's take a break, let's look into Humphrey Bogart's Western career, and then we'll be back with more High Noon and Rio Bravo. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. One really cool thing that we haven't touched on yet, Robert, is Robert. Hey, Robert.
Robert.
I hate when people do that. Like, hey, Mark.
Just say Robert Lamb.
Yeah, Robert Lamb. So one cool thing we haven't touched on is the producer of this movie, Stanley Kramer. And what I love about Stanley Kramer is the kind of story of how he started producing a lot of these movies. And I love how, you know, after the 40s, the kind of Hollywood studio system started to dissolve and independent picture houses started popping up all over the place making movies. And so Stanley Kramer, you know, he made that movie, The Champion, with Kirk Douglas. Then he made The Men with Brando in it. I think it was Brando's first role, which got him an Oscar nomination. So they were making these movies on the cheap with very good young actors like Kirk Douglas and Marlon Brando. And then this led him to make High Noon. And I love that this movie was really out of the studio system. And the reason Gary Cooper got this is because he wasn't really working within that studio system anymore. And he wasn't getting the best roles. So that's why he fought for this one.
Sometimes I wonder, like, it's just it always seems like studio interference really messes up a film. And I don't know if there's got to be cases where the studio intervenes and it actually is for the good. But I never hear those stories as much as I hear about how studio interference ruins a film like Alien 3 or some of the Marvel films or like, you know, whatever it is. Like there's somebody steps in and it just like ruins what could have been.
For every Rogue One, which I guess the studio stepped in and saved it, there is a Justice League.
Or Fantastic Four.
Yeah. I mean, I would have loved to have seen that kid's Fantastic Four because I heard he was going – I heard some behind-the-scenes stuff on that movie that was pretty crazy. I would have loved to have seen what that movie was. Just the most – I think they should have just released Zack Snyder's Justice League cut because, I mean, there's no way it could be worse than what they released.
Same with the Batman versus Superman. Wasn't there an extended cut?
Yeah. And did you hear the story about that? One time my brother-in-law were going to watch it, but we put the regular DVD in and watched the regular movie again, and we're like, is that an added scene? Is that – wait, that's added. Really. That's definitely added. That was one of the lowest moments of my life.
Because you had to watch it again. Yeah.
But no, I just kind of love how this movie, if you think about the way, I'm not going to say this is the way it was, but in the 90s, you had Miramax and Dimension making these movies with Kevin Smith and Robert Rodriguez and Tarantino and all these young hip Richard Linklater. And then the 50s, you had these new picture houses popping up and making this. So it's funny how Hollywood really does recycle itself, because if you think about, so you had them making these pictures in the early 50s, right? And then you have the kind of new wave of French cinema going on, but they kind of went back to lesser, because, you know, you still had the Hays Code and all that, and you went back to kind of more studio pictures in the 60s. But then in the late 60s, that's when Bonnie and Clyde and Graduate burst on the screen, the Midnight Cowboy and everything like that. Then
you and go Stanley through, Kubrick films,
yeah,
too. Stanley,
yeah, exactly. And then you have the 70s, which, you know, they kept the ball rolling with a lot of these unique pictures. I mean, you had, what, Blaxploitation, you had a lot of horror, drive-in films. But then Star Wars and Alien hit. And if you think about the 80s, then you had kind of – you had schlock horror, but you went back to the Amblin. You went back to, like, the kind of studio pictures. And then, you know, Sex, Lies, and Videotape happens from Soderbergh, and then you have Richard Linklater's Slacker, then you have Larry Clark with Kids, and it's kind of interesting how Hollywood kind of keeps doing the same thing over and over again. I mean, in the 20s, right, before the Hays Code, you had all these crazy bawdy movies, and then the Hays Code kicks in 32, and then movies change. And then you go through the studio pictures, then they started to change in the late 40s, 50s, because people are coming back from the war. So it's like these Hollywood movies are just one big cycle.
That's what I know. And I think sometimes when they step out of – when they – not every movie that's made outside like the main studios or that has to be funded its own way is going to turn out great. But a lot of times it gives the director and the other people involved more freedom to do it the way they want. And if you have a director who is also maybe like a writer or co-writer or actually has like a vision for the script – that they know won't be limited to the way that the studio wants it cut or anything, then they know it could be like – it could turn out a lot better than if if somebody else from an outside perspective stepped in. Although I will say something like Apocalypse Now, now that I've been thinking about it, did get some cuts, and those are probably good cuts.
I mean, if there wasn't intervention, everybody on that movie would have died.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Everyone's having heart attacks. Like, everyone's getting diseases. One interesting thing is, if you look at Netflix now, the good are starting to catch up with the bad. But you watch movies like Mute that came out, or other movies that are really anticipated. These guys have total freedom, and it kind of blows up in their faces. So I think with High Noon, they had the luxury of being able to make an under-the-radar cheap picture. However, I know Stanley Kramer and other people take credit for the editor takes credit for the movie because it won Best Editing and Academy Award. But then Stanley Kramer says he had he is the one who did it. Zinnemann says he did it. There were subplots in this movie about other criminals being taken some places. So it's interesting that this movie had at the same time a freedom, but it also had a lower budget, but it was also managed by several people who didn't really like it. So it's almost the beginning of freedom for filmmakers.
Right.
I don't know. I just think it's like a really interesting combination of the three, but it turned out to be a beautiful film. Very good movie.
And you know, see, I remember Francis Ford Coppola, I think, is the one who said that he didn't consider movies to be art because he said that art is a solo project and you can only really express art by like oneself. So a painting, a poem, a book, you know, one where somebody's just writing. But I understand what he's saying there, because like you're saying, you have all these people who are trying to take credit for different aspects of a film, and sometimes the studio interferes or sometimes other things happen. So I understand what he's saying, but I still consider it like a group project kind of art for film. And I think when you have something like this, that it all, I think to be considered art or to be considered a masterpiece or a classic is the fact that everything kind of melds together and it just works. Whether it meant to that way or not, it just kind of works.
No, yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, absolutely. And I think Kubrick, do you think he came close to being obviously it's a group project. Maybe we don't call them like art, but you have auteurs.
Mm-hmm.
Making cinematic art, I guess, because there's so many people. But
that's the thing, is there's so many people involved. But yeah, Stanley Kubrick, wrote and directed his stuff.
You watch a Wes Anderson movie, mm-hmm. and I mean, every frame is from Wes Anderson.
Right.
I mean, maybe he got some budget cuts, so he had to reevaluate scenes.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess Shyamalan got to a certain powerful enough to make his own art.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting point that you had. I think it does take a lot of people to kind of get it. And it does, you know, in movies, you definitely need a producer. You need a tough line producer there to say, no, we're shutting down production because it's gone over cost. So you do need, I guess when you're making a sculpture, you're making art, it's very solitary. But when you're one of these auteurs, you definitely need a tough producer who's behind the scenes sweating bullets. Getting you your 1967 couch from a brownstone in Boston that's 300 years old for a Wes Anderson movie. And so,
and you could also make the argument that, yeah, like somebody like Stanley Kubrick, where you look at 2001 A Space Odyssey or even something like The Shining and you say, like, that's a classic, that'll always be a classic, the way it's shot, the different scenes that represent certain storylines or pieces of like whatever ties it all together. You can say that a lot of it has to do with Stanley Kubrick and his vision, but also if you didn't have Jack Nicholson in there, or you didn't have maybe some of the cameramen that you had, like there are other aspects that lead to a film becoming a classic or becoming a masterpiece or whatever.
Like Peter Sellers and Dr. Strangelove improvising.
Right.
Kubrick.
Exactly. That's not part of it, but he comes up to it, and that's one of the things that people remember from the film. And like, it's a funny moment, and it's like, well, you know, that wouldn't have been there if it was just Kubrick.
And all right, this is going to sound insane, but so we did the Resident Evil podcast series, mm-hmm. and there's a commentary for every single one. And in one of them, Paul W.S. Anderson brings in one of the cinematographer to talk about the movie. And that cinematographer worked on 2001. And he said that they all called themselves the class of 2001 because they were all young and they were all learning together. And it was almost absolute freedom that they had, even though it was meticulous. They were all they called themselves the class of 2001 that worked on that movie. So you can't say it was all an auteurish product because it was a I'm just backing up what you said earlier with more pretentious stories. But I just wanted to back that up with Kubrick and how people were on set learning on the fly with what they were doing with him. And it felt like, well, that's interesting.
Yeah, I just find it that whole idea of what constitutes art or if film can even be considered art. You know what I mean?
I don't know, man. I think to some extent it can reach art. I would say The New World by Malick is art.
Yeah.
But that's about it. I mean,
it's hard. You watch The Godfather. To me, The Godfather, unbiasedly, is, I think, probably the best movie. I like Citizen Kane. I like Casablanca. I've seen all the classics and stuff like that. But I would say The Godfather would probably, to me, be if you had to pick one movie to represent all film, I would say it's probably The Godfather for me.
Man, I do. I pick Jumper.
Yeah. I'll take, you know what? Resident Evil Apocalypse.
Oh, that's the worst one. No, wait. Yeah, that's the second one. Yeah.
That's not the worst.
Oh, yeah. The worst one is two, and the worst are two and six.
No, I watch four. I couldn't even watch four.
Four will change your life. They use phantom cameras on that. That's like a 3D.
That was 3D, right?
Yeah, but they use phantom cameras, which Lars von Trier used on Melancholia. For me, Resident Evil 4, they tried to do really unique things.
Dude, the story is so convoluted, I just don't even know.
No, listen to the Plague Pot. If you listen to all six, they actually all make sense, which is kind of annoying because they shouldn't. Okay. All right, so Rio Bravo. I mean, we haven't touched much on Rio Bravo so far. How many have you watched? I have a question. I feel like Rio Bravo is easier to watch than High Noon, and it's 40 minutes longer.
It's not as intense and it's not as dramatic. I think it's a little bit more lighthearted than the other one, even though there is death and even though there are people who are dying that know John Wayne, that his friends that are killed and stuff. But I think for the most part, you know that the main characters are safe. I don't feel like it's you're not on the edge of your seat, but you do know there's bad guys out there waiting to kill them and stuff. But it's all very done in almost a pretty lighthearted way.
And it's more about just hanging out. It's more about, John Carpenter was talking about this movie, and he actually made Assault on Precinct 13 because he loved this movie so much. Mm. And he said it was just about the relationship between best friends, kind of dealing with trouble around each corner. It's kind of wild that this movie really influenced John Carpenter and Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, that's interesting. But I do like it in the sense of, yeah, it's these guys, not all of them know each other that well, but they all do have to just kind of all of a sudden they join forces and they're protecting the jail till the warden gets there or whatever. Even at near the end, John Wayne's you know what? We should have just been sitting in here the whole time rather than patrolling the streets, and let's just sit in here and wait for them to get here to get the prisoner. And that's why that becomes the last plan until things go awry.
Yeah, because in the beginning, they say that we don't want to change our schedule because then they'll think we're scared.
Right.
And then he's wait, we should have just been doing this the whole time.
Yeah, because the thing is, are they really going to fire into the what do you even call that? Not the holding cell, but where they were staying.
The jail?
I guess it's just the jail. Where they're all sitting around and stuff. Are they really going to fire in there? Because they might actually or accidentally kill Joe.
Yeah, and they had Stumpy sitting in there with him, just waiting to shoot Joe. And he said he would shoot Joe. I mean, yeah, they wouldn't really have come in.
Yeah, no, I don't think they would have gone in there. I think they would have, if anything, waited until he was taken, to go stand trial or something, and then maybe try to get him at that point.
I think the worst thing they could have done is shoot John Wayne's friend, that cool guy who said he stumbled over Dean Martin a lot. And because that puts Colorado on their side.
That's true. Yeah, that was kind of weird that they shot him.
Yeah, Colorado didn't even want to be involved.
Yeah, and it wasn't until they shot him, who was – isn't that Ward Bond?
Yeah.
That was his last movie.
Wow.
It was Rio Bravo.
Man, and he just got – so you shoot him, geez Louise.
Yeah, you shoot him, and then that forces Colorado to join, you know, John Wayne and Dee Martin and then Stumpy.
Which relationship did you have a better time buying, Angie Dickinson, John Wayne, or Grace Kelly and Gary Cooper?
The thing with Grace Kelly and Gary Cooper is they're not really together all that much. They are in the beginning when he explains things, and obviously she's upset and doesn't want – she's, like, so worried about, like, I just was married and now I'm going to become a widow kind of thing. And that kind of, that made a lot of sense to me. But I will say that I like the Rio Bravo, John Wayne, Angie Dickinson, because of they had more screen time together, and John Wayne seeing him get flustered was, like, an interesting – take.
Yeah, and Ebert even wrote about that. He's like, this massive John Wayne just sort of melts.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, I thought that was cool, like, just the way, like, because she was a fast talker, like, she was always talking, and even when she got nervous, she admitted that she talked a lot. So, like, the way, like, at the, like, near the end where he's like, you know, if you wear that outside, she's like telling him that she's going to wear like this dress or whatever. And she's like, but I wanted you to get jealous and not want me to wear this. He's like, well, I'll tell you this. If you go out there, I'm going to arrest you. And she's like, oh, I knew it. And then she comes back and she gets changed. And she's like, see, all you had to do is just say that you love me. He's like, I didn't say that. I said I'd arrest you. And she's like, oh, but for you, it means the same thing.
She's playing him. And I guess Howard Hawks really did have a history of that, kind of the good banter between like the one female character trying to get her way into the group of all men.
Right.
And I don't know, I dug that. And also, you know what's interesting is Gary Cooper at the time, so he was divorced from his wife or split from his wife, and he had a 26-year-old girlfriend when he was shooting High Noon. So I guess the relationship with Grace Kelly wasn't that weird.
I was going to say, didn't he have an affair with Grace Kelly? Or not an affair, but didn't they, like, hook up on set or something?
Oh, I didn't even know. I knew he had a tumultuous relationship with another 26-year-old.
Now, I thought it was...
What's Gary Cooper up to? What's he been drinking?
Well, that's also... I mean, John Wayne's, like, what, 50 in Rio Bravo? And Angie Dickinson's 24, 26, something like that, too?
But it kind of makes sense, because she's a world-weary criminal. And he's, like, that's this true. Older sheriff. But I guess it also makes sense a younger Quaker woman with, like, a older guy.
I also think that that's just, like, the times, too. Like, it didn't really matter how old the guy was.
Yeah, you're right.
Girls always were, like, younger. It's like a charade with Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn. Like, he was, like, over double her age.
The one weirdest movie, though, is what, Love in the Afternoon with Gary Cooper, right? And Audrey Hepburn?
Yeah.
No,
I know what you're talking about. It's a... is that what it's called? Love in the Afternoon?
Yeah, 57. Oh, wow. So he was like... Oh, but Billy Wilder directed. Yeah, he was probably 57, 58. And then Audrey was, you know, super young. That one there... And Gary didn't want to do it. He's like, I don't want to do this movie. But then he did it for Billy Wilder. That one hurts.
Yeah, I mean, that Cary Grant was the same way, where he was like, I don't want to do it anymore. Like, or I don't want to star... with Audrey Hepburn because it's like creepy and they're like, just do it. Same with Roger Moore with his last 007 with Tanya Roberts.
Yeah.
Where he's like, I don't know. I'm just like, I'm over double her age. And they're just like, but we really want you as 007. So he's like, fine.
It's kind of funny that happened with Gary Cooper, that happened with Cary Grant, and then it happened with Roger Moore. Well, they all seem like good dudes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, from what I've heard or read, they all didn't really want to do that, but they did.
Oh, well, I'll shake my, what do they call it? Shake my, I don't know. Never mind. So, I mean, if you had to recommend one of these movies to somebody, which one would you recommend?
So for me, I think High Noon is the better picture, but like you said, I think Rio Bravo is an easier watch. I think like Rio Bravo is more of a fun type Western to watch, whereas High Noon I think is a better overall, like artistically, just a better picture.
Wow. Yeah, man, I guess it just depends on who. I guess if I, because both of them are very iconic. Like, I guess
yeah, they are.
What I would do is like Rio Bravo, maybe I would recommend to film fans of the 90s or 80s. But, you know, John Carpenter made Assault on Precinct 13 because of this. This is Tarantino's favorite movie. You could really pitch it to people like that. But right. I guess if you're talking to cinephiles, you would just say High Noon because, you know, it happened during the dissolution of the studio system. All these great stories behind the behind-the-scenes stories. Academy Award for Best Song, Actor, Editing. You could really pitch it as that. Because
also, well, not to cut you off, but you could also say that if you like Westerns, I would say watch Rio Bravo. If you're not really big into Westerns, I would say check out High Noon.
Yeah, because that's the
anti-Western.
Yeah, they said it. They're like, not a Western.
Yeah.
In my notes. All right, well, that's cool. And then, let's see, anything else you want to cover on this movie, these movies?
Let me see what I wrote down. Just says,
That's funny. I just wrote down, not a Western.
Okay, so these are just like little kind of trivia tidbits that I got from IMDb that I thought were interesting. High Noon lost Best Picture to Greatest Show on Earth, but there's obviously politics involved. I forget who it was who directed Greatest Show on Earth, but he had kind of an in, and that's why they think that won Best Picture, because obviously that doesn't hold up as well as High Noon. Let me see. John Wayne in Rio Bravo, the hat he's wearing is the same one he wore since Stagecoach. He wore it in all his movies.
Yeah, isn't that awesome?
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. I wonder why he stopped wearing it after this one, though.
Too old.
I guess. It was starting to wear out. And then the other one was Walter Brennan. He was the first one to win three Oscars. First actor to win three Oscars, I think, right?
Really? Walter Brennan did that?
Yeah,
he was Stumpy, right?
Yeah, and he's won three Oscars for supporting actor. He was always a supporting actor.
He found a good niche.
Yeah, niche, I mean, he's good niche. As a supporting actor.
He found a good niche? Niche.
I do, you know what I do all the time? I always say ambience instead of ambiance. And I don't know, it just comes out, and I just say it fast, and I'm like, oh, I look like an idiot.
So which ones did he win for? Oh, wow, he was nominated for four Oscars, and he won for The Westerner, Kentucky, and Come and Get It.
Yeah, I haven't even seen any of those.
I like Come and Get It. Come on.
Yeah.
Was it? Oh, and then he also. Oh no, he was nominated for an Emmy. He could have been
If you look at his IMDb too, like he's in a lot of movies.
Oh, dude, crushed it, and he was great in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I loved him. Like I loved him as Stumpy. He added a lot to it.
I'm trying to say, he was in To Have and Have Not and Sergeant York and
Jumper.
Resident Evil Afterlife.
Yes, the good one.
Red River, that was another Western that's like an interesting one.
No, that's great to watch. I bought that in a 3-pack for about $6 one time. I was like, I'm buying this.
Nice.
Yeah. No, man, any other trivia?
No, those were the main ones. We already talked about some of the other stuff.
I love these movies.
Oh, wait. Oh, no, I do have one more. This one's kind of interesting, which I don't know if you know. This was on IMDb. It says that Sheb Woolley, who plays Ben Miller in High Noon, he's the originator of the Wilhelm scream.
Oh!
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
I almost don't believe it. Like, I want to look it up more. But that's what it said on IMDb. It said that take of the Wilhelm scream was in an earlier film, and then they reused it a couple times, most notably in Star Wars. And it's from Sheb Woolley, who played Ben Miller.
Yep, and that's from The Charge at Feather River.
Oh my God. That's awesome.
That throws me out of a movie now when I hear it.
Well, I mean, yeah, nowadays, yeah.
I love it. I would never want it to leave, but when I hear it, I'm like, oh, Wilhelm. Yep. Dude, that's awesome. Yeah.
But I wonder why it's called the Wilhelm Scream. Do you know?
For the song, stock sign, I don't know. We'll have to look it up. That'll be our next podcast.
Just movies that feature the Wilhelm scream.
The best ones. That'll be a great podcast. We can show all the clips.
Yeah.
Hey, well, thanks for recommending these, man, and thanks for coming on. I'm really glad we got to talk about these movies.
Yeah, that's cool. It's been a while since I've actually watched these films again.
We'll have to get you back in here for I think we should do a graduate podcast. All graduate?
I'd do that.
What do you think?
Yeah.
After Jumper.
Do a Jumper slash the Graduate.
Jumper and The Graduate?
I don't know how you connect those two, but there's got to be a way.
I mean, I could do it. I mean, we could Kevin Bacon it pretty easily. I mean, because you have Dustin Hoffman, and you could easily, you know, you got Sam Jackson.
That's true.
I mean, you could get those two together pretty quickly. Sam Jackson was in, let me see. All right, let's do this.
Sam Jackson's in everything, so you could say Pulp Fiction and kind of tie it in there.
With John Travolta. John Travolta's in Mad City with Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Wait, Mad City?
Yeah, Mad City.
I don't think I've ever seen Mad City.
It's in the 90s. Yeah. Man, we just did that quick.
Oh, there you go. That was fast.
Nailed it. 2 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Easy.
Wait, we didn't really Kevin Bacon it because we didn't go from Kevin Bacon.
Yeah, but you still did the 3 degrees of two actors, though.
I mean, I could connect Kevin Bacon to Sam Jackson pretty quickly.
Yeah, I feel Sam Jackson's like one of the easiest ones because he's been in so many different types of films. Although I read a long time ago, I think it was in the book Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell. I think it was Tipping Point. Maybe not. But there's a book, and I think it was Malcolm Gladwell, and it said that it was weird that Kevin Bacon was the one selected for that game when, like, they did studies about it, and they said that the best actor to connect everybody to would be Rod Steiger.
Okay.
Or Steiger. Is it Steiger?
What, In the Heat of the Night?
Yeah, because apparently he was in the most, like, wide range of films, they said, in the sense that he was in like B movies, like really crappy B movies. He was in Oscar winning movies. He was in all the different genres. And they said that they did a study and they actually listed out like all the actors and he was number one.
That's awesome.
That's so weird.
Did you happen to see the article I wrote about Kevin Bacon?
No.
All right. So movies that feature Kevin Bacon where he has 2 degrees, like collegiate degrees.
Oh, nice.
make more money and have higher Rotten Tomato scores. So he's never the star in them, in the movies where he has 2+ collegiate degrees or graduate, undergraduate. But when he has 2 degrees, collegiate degrees in a movie, they make more money and they have higher critical scores.
Hey, that's interesting.
That's stupid, but that's my data right there. Oh, yeah, dude. Steiger was in, like, Mars Attacks. Let's see.
He died, though, right?
Yeah, and he was in End of Days. He was in The Hurricane. I mean, this guy's been – I mean, you could tie tons of people with him.
Yeah, I just thought it was just such a weird name to hear, like, out of all the actors you think of. I mean, it might be different now, too, because I read that. That was, like – that had to be, like, 8 years ago, so it might be different. It might be Samuel Jackson or somebody. But, I mean, you look at Rod Steiger and you see Duck, You Sucker, and then you also see On the Waterfront, In the Heat of the Night. And then, like, yeah, newer movies like The Hurricane and The Kid and stuff like that. I mean, so,
everyone's in Mars Attacks.
That's true, too. Dang.
We solved it.
Nice.
All right, dude. Well, hey, thank you for coming in, man. And so for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, and for Robert Lamb, this is Movies, Films, and Flicks, and we'll see you next week.